Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Having a sense of purpose may help you sleep at night, by Amanda McMillan for Real Simple. How well you snooze at night has a lot to do with how you spend your days. Sleep quality has been linked with everything from diet and exercise to electronic screen use. Now a new study suggests that something a little less tangible may play a role as well. People who have a strong purpose in life tend to sleep better through the night, with fewer symptoms of sleep apnea and restless legs. Published in the journal Sleep Science and Practice, the study suggests that cultivating a sense of purpose could be a good drug-free strategy for improving shut-eye. And while the study only included adults ages 60 and up, the authors say their findings would also likely apply to younger age groups. The researchers from Northwestern University and Rush University Medical Center knew that sense of purpose, defined in the study as having aspirations and goals for the future and feeling that experiences in life are meaningful, has been linked with numerous health outcomes, including reduced risks of stroke and disability and a longer life. It's also been shown to improve sleep when measured at a single point in time. To study the connection over a longer period, the researchers recruited 823 participants, average age 79, and gave them a survey to assess their overall sleep quality and the likelihood they suffered from conditions such as sleep apnea, which affects breathing and oxygen levels during sleep, and restless leg syndrome, during which uncomfortable sensations and an urge to move keep people awake at night. The participants also answered questions to determine their psychological well-being and whether they had a purpose in life. Specifically, they were asked to rate their responses to statements such as, "I feel good when I think of what I've done in the past and what I hope to do in the future," and "Some people wander aimlessly through life, but I am not one of them." Overall, those who scored higher on the Purpose in Life questionnaire were 63% less likely to have sleep apnea and 52% less likely to have restless leg syndrome than those who scored lower. They also had moderately better sleep quality scores at the start of the study and showed increased improvement over a one-year period. One interpretation of our findings is that individuals with a high purpose in life tend to have better overall mental and physical health, the authors wrote. In other words, they sleep better because they have fewer health issues keeping them up at night. Another possibility is that people with higher levels of purpose tend to engage in more healthy behaviors, such as exercise, regular doctor's visits, and relaxing hobbies. This finding could be especially important for older adults, the authors say, since insomnia and other sleep problems tend to increase with age. Doctors prefer to treat these issues without pharmaceuticals when possible, and this study may suggest that having a good reason to get up every morning may help in that regard. This study is also significant in that more than half of the participants were African American, a group that's often left out of scientific research, and that tends to have higher rates of sleep disturbance than their white peers. It appears that for both African American and white American older adults, the more meaning and purpose one has in daytime activities, the better one tends to sleep at night, the authors wrote in their paper. Addressing sleep disorders and disturbances is vital to overall health, the authors wrote. Poor quality shut-eye has been linked to many physical and mental health problems, including depression, heart disease, and impaired physical functioning. The authors say the next step in this research should be to study exactly how people can find or enhance their purpose in life, perhaps through mindfulness-based therapies. If those enhancements do in fact improve sleep, they could be a valuable tool for improving shut-eye for people of all ages. This article originally appeared on realsimple.com. These 100 companies are responsible for most of the world's carbon emissions. By Lucinda Shen. About 100 companies have been responsible for about 71% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. That's according to a new report from climate change nonprofit CDP in conjunction with the Climate Accountability Institute. The report hopes to highlight the role such companies and their investors play in climate change. These companies, led by Saudi Aramco, Russian gas giant Gazprom, and ExxonMobil, have produced about 923 billion tons of carbon dioxide equivalents between 1988 to 2016. State-owned coal producers in China and India also feature in the top 10, as do Mexican oil producer Pemex and the National Iranian Oil Corporation. Of the top 10, only ExxonMobil and Royal Dutch Shell are majority owned by private investors, although CDP has, for some reason, listed a bundle of privately held companies into what it calls Russia Coal at number 7. The burning of fossil fuels has increased by orders of magnitude in the last 30 years, as China and India have joined the process of industrialization that the West started in the middle of the 18th century. More greenhouse gases were emitted from human activity in the last 30 years than in the previous 150, according to CDP's research. Despite rapid growth in the use of renewable energy sources such as wind and solar, companies and governments across the world are struggling to master the transition from fossil fuels. Fossil fuel companies are also going to have to demonstrate leadership as part of this transition, wrote Pedro Faria, technical director of the CDP. They owe it to the millions of clients they serve that are already feeling the effects of climate change, and to the many millions more that require energy for the comfort of their daily lives but are looking for alternatives to their products. Notably, ExxonMobil investors recently called for the company to provide a future plan in case of stronger climate change regulations. This is an unprecedented victory at Exxon for investors in the fight to ensure a smooth transition to a low-carbon economy, said New York State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli at the time. You can check out the total list of the 100 companies at Fortune.com. What's next for Mosul after it was liberated from ISIS? By Rebecca Collard in Mosul. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has announced that Mosul is officially free from ISIS, despite a few dozen militants making a last stand. The sound of gunfire rang out from the old city Monday, and plumes of smoke rose above the historic structures. ISIS militants have vowed to fight to the death in the few streets they still control. It took ISIS just days to take Mosul in June of 2014, but it has taken Iraqi forces more than 8 months of hard fighting to win it back. That fight, backed by militia and heavy airstrikes by the U.S.-led coalition, has left Mosul in ruins and done little to repair the sectarian tension among Iraqis. Iraq's army and police now control most streets of the country's second-largest city, along with militia fighters. They hold their weapons next to piles of rubble and bent metal that were once Mosul's homes, shops, institutions, and government buildings. Most of the structures still standing are littered with bullet and mortar holes. The bridges that used to connect the east and west sides of the city over the Tigris River are destroyed. The United Nations warned Monday that an end of fighting in the city would not relieve the humanitarian crisis in the country. The organization says it will take billions of dollars and years to rebuild the city. Until then, most of nearly 1 million civilians displaced by the fighting will languish in camps in northern Iraq. Those that remain in the city complain of a lack of water and electricity, even in areas reclaimed months ago. Today, men and boys gathered around a water tap in eastern Mosul, washing their faces and filling buckets to take home. There's no water, no electricity, and no work, says Taha Mohammed Ibrahim. The fighting has damaged much of the city infrastructure, and while many shops and markets have reopened, many more have not. Ibrahim says that every few days city water does arrive in his home, but the smell is so bad his family doesn't use it. Posters celebrating the army's defeat of ISIS line the streets of eastern Mosul. Another reads, "Mosul is the city of peaceful coexistence." Like many here, Ibrahim is happy the government is back in control after years under the ISIS militants, but he's worried about a return to the sort of oppression many Sunni residents felt under Baghdad's rule before ISIS came. "We would queue for hours at checkpoints," says Ibrahim. "Security forces would just arrest innocent people." At a screening center nearby, families arrive from Mosul's old city. Men and older boys are separated from women and children. They are questioned, and two men on laptops check their names against a database of those wanted by security forces. 90% of these people are ISIS families, says Lieutenant Colonel Jabbar Mustafa, who is in charge of the center. Those believed to be ISIS are sent to a prison in a nearby town, and the rest transferred to packed displacement camps. Human rights groups have accused security forces of torture and arbitrary detentions in centers like these, though Mustafa denies that. The resentment of the Shia-led government in Baghdad that facilitated ISIS's quick advance across Iraq in 2014 still festers. Many Sunnis in Mosul and the surrounding villages welcomed ISIS 3 years ago, describing Iraqi forces' presence like an occupation of the city. Rebuilding Mosul will be expensive, but rebuilding trust among Iraqis will be even more difficult. Sunni leaders say little has been done to address the grievances of their community. "We need to start a new page where the Sunnis will be real participants in the political process," says Intisar al-Jabouri, a member of the Iraqi parliament from Mosul. "They need to be seen as equal citizens of Iraq and not as second-degree citizens." Jabouri says the government must work to rebuild the trust and coexistence that she says they once had in Mosul, and national reconciliation is key, but that hasn't been a priority as Iraqi forces fought hard to push ISIS out of the country's cities and villages. "It needs time and a big effort," she says, "but if that doesn't happen, it may lead to a civil war." Donald Trump's team keeps changing their Russia stories. By Zeke J. Miller. Just days after his father secured the Republican nomination, Donald Trump Jr. appeared on CNN to rebut what had become a frequent charge of Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. Russians were seeking to help his father's presidential campaign. "It's disgusting. It's so phony," the younger Trump said on July 24, 2016. But the younger Trump has since admitted that he was not saying everything he knew at the time. Weeks earlier, Trump had met with a Russian lawyer with ties to the Kremlin, Natalia Veselnitskaya, who had promised she might have information helpful to the campaign, according to a statement released Monday by the younger Trump's attorney. The New York Times reported hours later that Trump Jr. was told in an email that the Russian government was the source of the information Veselnitskaya would present. The new revelations fit a pattern that has dogged President Donald Trump and his aides through the first months of their administration. Time and again, those close to the president and the president himself have had to change their stories about their proximity to Russian officials during the election campaign and shortly afterwards as new contradictory information comes to light. "Did I meet with people that were Russian? I'm sure I did," Donald Trump Jr. told the Times in March, "but none that were set up, none that I can think of at the moment, and certainly none that I was representing the campaign in any way, shape, or form." He now says he invited both the campaign manager, Paul Manafort, and another top campaign aide, Jared Kushner, to sit in on the meeting with Veselnitskaya, knowing they would discuss information about the Clinton campaign. This directly contradicts the claims of several senior Trump aides that this sort of contact never took place. "There was no communication between the campaign and any foreign entity during the campaign," said Trump spokeswoman Hope Hicks shortly after the November election last year. "Of course not. Why would there be any contacts?" said Vice President Mike Pence on January 15th when asked on Fox News if there were any contacts between Trump or his associates and the Kremlin or cutouts. Inside the Trump administration, there appears to have been little internal efforts to fact-check these denials before they were made. The latest meeting with Trump Jr. was uncovered only after Kushner and Manafort disclosed the meeting to investigators looking into potential collusion on the part of the Trump campaign with Russian agents. After first saying the meeting only regarded a block on Russian adoptions, the younger Trump admitted 24 hours later it had a different purpose. Obviously, I'm the first person on a campaign to ever take a meeting to hear info about an opponent, Trump tweeted Monday, trying to explain away the controversy. Went nowhere, but had to listen. The assertion that it was an innocuous meeting would be easier to accept had it not followed on more than a half dozen similar revelations in recent months that contradicted previous denials of Russian contact with Trump's circle. Kushner, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and former National Security Advisor Mike Flynn were all forced to acknowledge previously undisclosed contacts with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. Flynn's discussion with Kislyak about sanctions ultimately cost him his job after he misled Vice President Pence about the nature of his conversations. Sessions' contacts forced his recusal from overseeing the ongoing Russia investigation. Trump himself has been the source of much of the confusing talk about Russia, denying meetings only to be proven wrong and misstating even his own communications with Russian leaders in recent days. Trump met with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Friday. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson recounted a day later that the men discussed U.S. sanctions on Russia. Less than 24 hours later, the president tweeted, "Sanctions were not discussed at my meeting with President Putin." On Monday, White House Principal Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Sanders restated, without explaining Trump's tweet, there were sanctions specific to election meddling that were discussed. The president also said he discussed forming a joint, impenetrable cybersecurity unit with Putin to protect elections. He walked back the half-baked plan hours later, but not before Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin hailed it as a strategic alliance and a very significant accomplishment for President Trump. Even White House allies have been exasperated by the constantly shifting narratives on Russia and the steady revelations that have kept the firestorm alive. Some have expressed frustration that the White House has not had a better way to get ahead of the story. White House officials claim the revision and correction of past stories about Russia contact stems from Trump's own sensitivity to the issue and his worry that the Russian investigation undermines his legitimacy. The persistence of the confusion is colored by the fact that it took Trump months to publicly accept the conclusions of the U.S. intelligence community that Russia was behind election-related hacks in 2016. Shortly after the election, he rejected those conclusions as politically motivated in an interview with Time. "I don't believe it. I don't believe they interfered," he said, when asked about the conclusion that Russia was involved in stealing emails from the Democratic National Committee. Trump has never publicly affirmed the intelligence community's assessment that it was part of an operation to assist his campaign, despite multiple briefings on the subject. As recently as last week in Poland, Trump gave a jumbled answer to a question about whether Russia was responsible for interfering in the 2016 election. "I think it was Russia, and I think it could have been other people and other countries. It could have been a lot of people that interfered," he said. "Nobody really knows for sure." One day later, the White House aide said Trump raised the issue of hacking with Putin multiple times, with the Russian leader later telling reporters he believed his answers satisfied the American president. "Look, he heard Putin's denial, and he knew that at the end of the day, the important part was them being able to have that conversation, him to directly ask him," Sanders said Monday. "He heard his answer, and he moved forward with places that they thought they could work together."
The $10 lifetime National Park Pass for seniors is about to get a lot more expensive. By Judy Kalfas. For just $10, older Americans have been able to access all of the country's national parks for the rest of their lives. But come August 28th, that fee will rise to $80. On Monday, the National Park Service announced that it would be increasing prices for senior lifetime passes later this summer. The agency has offered its $10 lifetime senior park pass for American citizens who are 62 or older since 1994, and the price increase comes as a result of legislation approved by Congress in December 2016 as a result of the National Park Service's centennial. The pass permits lifetime entry to more than 2,000 sites and parks across the country. Those who purchase the passes while they are $10 will still be able to use them without an additional charge, the National Park Service said Monday. The Park Service believes that even with the price increase, the pass is still a bargain for seniors. National parks like Yosemite, the Grand Canyon, Yellowstone, and others each charge $30 for entry for visitors. If a senior visits three of the $30 parks, he or she has already saved money, Kathy Cooper, a spokesperson for the National Park Service, told Money last month. Plus, the pass allows those traveling with seniors to enter the park with them. Under the Obama administration, Congress approved the National Park Service Centennial Act, which raised park fees and addressed infrastructure issues in national parks. The legislation also created a new annual pass for seniors, which can be purchased for $20. If seniors buy four of the new annual passes, they can get a lifetime pass for no additional cost, the Park Service said. The Vatican says gluten-free wafers can't be used for communion, by Kevin Liu. The Roman Catholic Church will not allow its congregations to be given gluten-free wafers, called hosts, or bread, for celebrating the Eucharist during Mass, according to its latest directive at the behest of Pope Francis. The ban comes from a letter to Catholic bishops worldwide, published Saturday by Vatican Radio. The detailed guidelines are needed, according to Cardinal Robert Sarra of the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments, as Eucharist bread and wine are widely available for sale nowadays, even over the Internet. Bread and wafers used in the sacrament must be unleavened, purely of wheat, and recently made so that there is no danger of decomposition, the letter reads. Hosts that are completely gluten-free are invalid matter for the celebration of the Eucharists. The letter adds that low-gluten hosts, partially gluten-free, are valid for communion use, provided they have sufficient amount of gluten to obtain the confection of bread, and follow other rules for Eucharist bread. The wine, meanwhile, must be natural, from the fruit of the grape, pure and incorrupt, not mixed with other substances. Both bread and wine made from genetically modified organisms, however, are perfectly acceptable. Catholic teachings hold that the bread and wine served during the Eucharist, a sacrament also known by names like Holy Communion or the Lord's Supper, constitute the literal body and blood of Christ through a process called transubstantiation. There are about 1.27 billion Catholics worldwide, according to Vatican figures.
Get ready, science nerds. Incredible Jupiter photos are coming, by Mahita Gajanan. Scientists will soon get humanity's closest ever look at Jupiter's mysterious landmark, the Great Red Spot. NASA's Juno spacecraft will fly over the planet's most famous feature just after 10 p.m. Eastern Time Monday. It will then pass about 5,600 miles above the top of Jupiter's clouds. The Great Red Spot, which takes up about 10,000 miles, is a giant storm that has churned on Jupiter for hundreds of years. Scientists, long puzzled by the gigantic storm, have monitored it since 1830. Juno's trip to the spot is the closest any spacecraft has ever gotten. Now Juno and her cloud-penetrating science instruments will dive in to see how deep the roots of this storm go and help us understand how this giant storm works and what makes it so special, Scott Bolton, NASA's principal investigator of Juno, said in a statement. Juno has been in Jupiter's orbit for just a little more than a year, according to NASA. The spacecraft launched in August 2011. Black China was just granted a temporary restraining order against Rob Kardashian by the Associated Press in Los Angeles. A court commissioner has granted Rob Kardashian's ex-fiancée Black China a temporary restraining order against the reality television star. Los Angeles Superior Court Commissioner James E. Blancard issued the order Monday, pending a hearing set for August 8th. Blanchard did not detail what the restraining order restrictions would entail at a brief hearing. He said his primary concern was Kardashian and China's infant baby. China sought a temporary restraining order on Monday, less than a week after Kardashian posted explicit images of her and attacked her online in posts on Instagram and Twitter. Her attorney, Lisa Bloom, has accused Kardashian of cyberbullying. Kardashian did not appear at Monday's hearing. His lawyer, Robert Shapiro, apologized on his client's behalf outside the courthouse.
Mindfulness may lower blood sugar levels, by Amanda McMillan. Being overweight is stressful on the body, and stress can worsen obesity-related health issues and make it harder to shed pounds, throwing people into a vicious cycle that seems impossible to escape. Now, a new study published in the journal Obesity offers a strategy that may help. In a group of overweight women, mindfulness training reduced stress and fasting blood sugar levels better than traditional health education classes. To study the effects of mindfulness, researchers from Penn State University randomly assigned 86 overweight or obese women to receive 8 weekly sessions of either mindfulness-based stress reduction, MBSR, taught by a professional instructor, or general health education, taught by a registered dietitian. The MBSR group learned how to use mindfulness techniques like meditation and breath awareness to respond to stress. The health education group learned about diet, exercise, obesity-related health issues, and general stress management. The goal of these sessions was not to help people lose weight, but to reduce stress and stress-related health problems. In that sense, mindfulness worked better. After 8 weeks of training and 8 more weeks of home practice, perceived stress scores for women in the MBSR group had decreased 3.6 points from the start of the study on a 10-point scale, compared to only 1.3 points for women in the health education group. Both groups experienced improvements in mood, psychological distress, and sleep-related problems, but only the MBSR group saw a decrease in fasting blood sugar levels, both right after training was completed and when the women were retested 8 weeks later. The researchers also tested the women for other health outcomes, including weight, body mass index, weight circumference, blood pressure, fasting insulin, cholesterol, inflammatory markers, and levels of stress hormones, but they saw no significant changes for these measurements in either group. Still, the decrease in blood sugar levels could be enough to have real health implications, say the study authors. While they did not ask the women to report what or how much they ate, they hypothesized that increased mindfulness could have made it easier for the MBSR group to adhere to the diet and exercise guidelines we gave them, they wrote in the paper. Only 71% of the study participants completed the 8-week training sessions, and only 62% stuck with the research for all 16 weeks, which reduces the strength of the findings. But the authors wrote that most dropouts were in the health education group, which is evidence that the current standard of care is ineffective and unappealing to patients. The fact that more women completed the mindfulness training than the health education, 83% versus 59%, lends support to the feasibility and acceptability of MBSR in women with overweight or obesity, they added. More research in larger and more varied groups of people is needed to determine the mechanisms through which mindfulness-based stress reduction may lower blood sugar, and to see whether sustained increases in mindfulness over longer periods of time would result in even greater and lasting benefits, the authors wrote. If, as our study suggests, MBSR lowers glucose in people with overweight or obesity, then it could be an effective tool for preventing or treating type 2 diabetes, they wrote.
Had to Listen, Donald Trump Jr. Defends Controversial Russia Meeting, by Maya Rodin. Donald Trump Jr. addressed his recently disclosed meeting with a Russian lawyer who has links to the Kremlin in a tweet early Monday, claiming the conversation went nowhere, but he had to listen. Obviously, I'm the first person on a campaign to ever take a meeting to hear info about an opponent, Trump tweeted. Went nowhere, but had to listen. The New York Times first reported that Trump Jr., the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort met with Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya last June amid the 2016 election. Veselnitskaya reportedly promised to offer information that would be damaging to the Clinton campaign. Donald Trump Jr. confirmed that he took the meeting on Sunday, saying that he met with the lawyer at the request of an acquaintance from the 2013 Miss Universe pageant, which was held in Moscow. Trump's Trump's tweet included a New York Post story that dismissed the report on his Russia meeting as a big yawn. White House counselor Kellyanne Conway appeared on Good Morning America on Monday, where she said that no information was received that was meaningful or helpful and no action was taken as a result of the meeting. When asked why the meeting was not initially disclosed, Conway said disclosure statements had been amended to reflect the meeting.
Tesla Model 3 pictures. Elon Musk reveals production photos. By Andrew Nuska and Kirsten Korosek. Tesla Motors' long-awaited Model 3, its mass-market model, is finally revealed thanks to a series of late-night tweets by CEO Elon Musk. Production Unit 1 of Model 3 is now built and going through final checkout, Musk tweeted around 8 p.m. Eastern. Pick soon. The chief executive delivered on his promise. Just after midnight Eastern, he published two photos of the vehicle, one in monochrome and a second in full color. Who's the lucky owner of the first Model 3? Musk himself, but only after some horse trading. Venture capitalist Ira Ehrenpreis had the rights to the first car. He was the first to place a full deposit for the vehicle, but later gave those rights to Musk as his 46th birthday present. Musk owns the first Roadster and Model X, but not the first Model S. A lot is riding on the Model 3. It's the vehicle that Tesla, this year a Fortune 500 company for the first time, hopes will help boost it into profitability. At $35,000, before incentives, it's also the vehicle that Musk believes will be the breakthrough to bringing electric vehicles to the average American home. The Model 3 promises a range of 215 miles per charge. Investors agree. Though Tesla has not hit all of its milestones on time, it does eventually hit them. Production for the Model 3 was originally slated to start in July, but Tesla now hopes to build 5,000 Model 3 sedans per week by the end of this year and 10,000 per week in 2018. Trump backtracks on his idea for a joint cybersecurity unit with Russia after harsh criticism. By Phil Stewart and Valerie Volkovici for Reuters. U.S. President Donald Trump on Sunday backtracked on his push for a cybersecurity unit with Russia, tweeting that he didn't think it could happen, hours after his proposal was harshly criticized by Republicans who said Moscow could not be trusted. Trump said on Twitter early on Sunday that he and Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed on Friday forming an impenetrable cybersecurity unit to address issues like the risk of cyber meddling in elections. The idea appeared to be a political non-starter. It was immediately scorned by several of Trump's fellow Republicans, who questioned why the United States would work with Russia after Moscow's alleged meddling in the 2016 U.S. election. It's not the dumbest idea I've ever heard, but it's pretty close, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina told NBC's Meet the Press program. Ash Carter, who was U.S. Defense Secretary until the end of former Democratic President Barack Obama's administration in January, told CNN flatly, "This is like the guy who robbed your house proposing a working group on burglary." Trump's advisors, including Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, had recently sought to explain Trump's cyber push. Mnuchin said on Saturday that Trump and Putin had agreed to create a cyber unit to make sure that there was absolutely no interference whatsoever, that they would work on cybersecurity together. But Trump returned to Twitter on Sunday to play down the idea, which arose at his talks with Putin at a summit of the Group of 20 Nations in Hamburg, Germany. "The fact that President Putin and I discussed a cybersecurity unit doesn't mean I think it can happen. It can't," Trump said on Twitter. He then noted that an agreement with Russia for a ceasefire in Syria can and did happen. Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona acknowledged Trump's desire to move forward with Russia, but added, "There has to be a price to pay." "There has been no penalty," McCain, who chairs the Senate Armed Services Committee, told CBS's Face the Nation program, according to a CBS transcript. "Vladimir Putin got away with literally trying to change the outcome of our election." Trump argued for a rapprochement with Moscow in his campaign, but has been unable to deliver because his administration has been dogged by investigations into the allegations of Russian interference in the election and ties with his campaign. Special Counsel Robert Mueller is investigating the matter, including whether there may have been any collusion on the part of Trump campaign officials, as are congressional committees, including both the House of Representatives and Senate intelligence panels. Those probes are focused almost exclusively on Moscow's actions, lawmakers and intelligence officials say, and no evidence has surfaced publicly implicating other countries, despite Trump's suggestion that others could have been involved. Moscow has denied any interference, and Trump says his campaign did not collude with Russia. Representative Adam Schiff, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, told CNN's State of the Union program that Russia could not be a credible partner in a cybersecurity unit. If that's our best election defense, we might as well just mail our ballot boxes to Moscow, Schiff added. Separately, U.S. government officials said a recent hack into business systems of U.S. nuclear power and other energy companies was carried out by Russian government hackers, The Washington Post reported on Saturday. Trump said he strongly pressed President Putin twice about Russian meddling in our election. He vehemently denied it, Trump said. He added, "We negotiated a ceasefire in parts of Syria which will save lives. Now it is time to move forward in working constructively with Russia." In Trump's first attempt at ending the 6-year Syrian civil war, the United States, Russia, and Jordan on Friday reached a ceasefire and de-escalation agreement for southwestern Syria. The ceasefire was holding hours after it took effect on Sunday, a monitor and two rebel officials said. Any joint U.S.-Russia cyber initiative would have been a different matter. Depending on how much it veered into military or espionage operations, it could have faced major legal hurdles. Language in the 2017 National Defense Authorization Act prohibits the Pentagon, which includes the National Security Agency and the U.S. Military Cyber Command, from using any funds for bilateral military cooperation with Russia. Michael McFaul, a former U.S. ambassador to Russia, also noted restrictions on sharing information with Russia that would clearly prohibit offering Moscow a sense of U.S. cyber capabilities. Russia would be similarly adverse to revealing its capabilities to the United States, he noted. It just will not happen, McFaul told Reuters. Turkish opposition leader ends 25-day march with Istanbul rally, by Jared Malzin. Addressing huge throngs of people at a rally in Istanbul on Sunday, the leader of Turkey's mainstream opposition, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, issued a thunderous demand for an end to an ongoing government crackdown under President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The rally represented the largest public display of opposition to the clampdown of Erdogan's government since he survived a failed military coup attempt nearly a year ago. More than 47,000 people have been detained since the government suppressed the attempt to seize power by a faction of the armed forces on July 15, 2016. This is the era of dictatorship. This is the era of 1940s Germany, said Kılıçdaroğlu, addressing a huge throng of demonstrators at a parade grounds along the Sea of Marmara. With this rally, we witness that we are not alone. Each one of us represents hope, he also said. Kılıçdaroğlu spoke at the rally after walking about 280 miles from Ankara in protest of the crackdown, which has led to the arrest of journalists, academics, and members of parliament. Kılıçdaroğlu set out from the capital on June 15th, a day after a member of parliament from his Republican People's Party, CHP, was arrested, joining at least 11 other opposition lawmakers who have been detained in recent months. After marching through the Turkish countryside for more than 3 weeks, Kılıçdaroğlu arrived in Istanbul on Saturday, leading a throng of thousands of protesters. The protest raised fears of a confrontation when the crowd arrived in the city, but there were no signs of violence. Police had provided security for Kılıçdaroğlu and the protesters during their long walk from Ankara. On Sunday, Kılıçdaroğlu chose to walk alone on the final stretch to the rally. I reached the end of my walk, but this is not the end. It is the beginning of a new era, he said, speaking to a cheering crowd that chanted, Rights, Law, Justice. Though it was organized by the CHP, the organizers of both the march and rally eschewed party insignia, instead distributing signs that read Adalet, Justice. The crowd waved Turkish flags. Kılıçdaroğlu has been criticized in the past for failing to organize a credible opposition to the crackdown in the aftermath of the July 15th coup attempt. However, his march across the country captured a piece of Turkey's national political conversation. The demonstration in Istanbul was a show of force for Turkey's mainstream opposition, and CHP supporters were heavily represented in the crowd. The protest also attracted support from members of the broader Turkish public. I want justice for everyone in this country. I want justice for my children, said Saimi Kirik, 55, as she stood in the afternoon sun awaiting Kılıçdaroğlu's arrival. She said she'd been unable to find work for 5 years. A populist leader who has dominated Turkish politics for about 15 years, President Erdogan is a deeply polarizing figure, equally loved and hated by rival political camps within Turkey. In recent years, he's sidelined other leaders within his own party and moved to restrict political opponents. The coup attempt led to an acceleration of the clampdown, including the closure of dozens of news organizations and the firing of top military officers and tens of thousands of civil servants. In April, Erdogan also won a disputed victory in a referendum on a constitutional overhaul to replace Turkey's parliamentary system of government with one dominated by a powerful presidency. The government argued the changes were needed to impose stability, while the opposition denounced it as a power grab. The vote itself was also marred by widespread claims of fraud. The referendum marked another step in a larger struggle over the future of Turkey's democracy. In his speech on Sunday, Kılıçdaroğlu issued a list of demands, including freeing the judiciary from the influence of the ruling party, releasing journalists from prison, and greater prosperity for all Turkish citizens. He did not articulate a specific plan to achieve those goals, and even some of the protesters in the crowd expressed skepticism about whether the demonstration would result in concrete changes. Unless Erdogan says yes, nothing will change in this country, said a 60-year-old teacher from Istanbul who also stood in the crowd. She asked for her name to be withheld for fear that she could lose her job for publicly criticizing the government. The number of demonstrators at Sunday's rally was a matter of dispute, as CHP officials claimed more than 2 million people attended the protest in Istanbul's suburban Maltepe district. The Istanbul regional government placed attendance at 175,000. Turkey's official Anadolu news agency reported that 15,000 police officers had been deployed to provide security. Regardless of the turnout, some members of the opposition left the demonstration energized. I feel like I'm more hopeful for the future. I feel like a new person now, said Fari Gökdal, 61, a retired civil servant who came to the rally from the town of Buryani, about a 5-hour drive south of Istanbul. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.